Okay.
We're going to tackle a difficult topic today. Parshas Vayishlach is like jam-packed with very difficult scenes. Originally, I thought we could tackle the story of Reuven and his story, but I'm not going to for now. I decided to change my mind. Perhaps maybe we'll touch upon it. Reuven and the beds, which describes that he laid with Bilha, the Pilegesh, the concubine of his father. We might be able to take an opportunity to touch upon that story, but for the most part, I want to tackle a more controversial story that's going to make everybody unhappy, and that's the story of Dina. Dina, if we remember, is the daughter of Leah. She is the one daughter that's mentioned. Imagine there had to be other daughters, that it couldn't be that there was something in the water, that they just had 12 sons and one daughter, right? Because trust me, I tried this and I ended up with one son. So there's no secret. From experience. They tell me you got a 50-50 shot, which I don't know, whatever, but nonetheless. So there had to be other daughters, but Dina's the only one mentioned when she's born. The Midrash has a field day with the fact, with her story about when she was born, but nonetheless, I think she's mentioned her when she's born because she becomes relevant again in the story that we're about to read now. Okay, and this is a story that, like whatever way you look at it, it's a terrible story. It's a terrible story in so many ways. And what I would hope. Hello. How are you, Pat?
Hello,
Rabbi. Hi, honey. Whatever story, whatever way you want, the goal.
I can move over one chair.
We're good. They got the corner office here. All right. Whatever way, what I want to do at the end of the class is I want you to be the judge. Meaning, I want you to argue one way or another who's right and who's wrong. And I say we could do this because the text is ambiguous. And if we tell you, if the text is intentionally ambiguous, it means that we're supposed to argue. We're supposed to have different ways of looking at it. Everybody with me so far? Okay. So if you open up your book, we're gonna do a text study. So we're going to try to at least get shots and understand of what's happening in this story. So if you open up your book, we are on Parshat Vayishlach. And the bottom of page 83. Chapter 34, it says in the left corner, Dina's abduction. Now, I want you to keep in mind that this is the translation, of course, is translation is always interpretation, and the art scroll, which is going to make it a PG-13 rated, probably even PG or maybe even G rated, they're going to take some liberty. So we're going to have to do some translation along the way on our own. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Great. Vateitze Dina bat Leah, and now Dina, the daughter of Leah, she went out. Ashel yelda li Yaakov, that she was given birth to Yaakov, lirot b'vnot ha'aretz, went to look out for the daughters of the land. Not even sure what that means, right? She went out to see the daughters of the land, right? To look over the daughters of the land. Probably she was an older daughter, right, or something like that, and so she went out. Vayar Altao Shechem, son of Hamor the Chivite, the prince of the region, saw her. He took her, lay with her, and violated her. Okay? So what happens in this situation is that Hamor, who is the mayor's son, right? Shechem is the son of Hamor. Hamor is like the mayor of the town, right? How big is this town? We don't know. But what we do know at the end of the story is that what happens to this town? Two teenagers wipe them out, right? Shimon and Levi wipe them out. That's the end of the story. I gave it away, spoiler alert, right? But so we'd say, wow, that was unbelievable that they wiped them out, even if we'll see that they were in a compromised state. But the town can't be that big. Because even if they were... There's still two teenagers, right? Actually, the tradition tells us that they were 13 years old at the time, about 13 years old at the time, because they're referred to as an ish. And actually, this is the source. Drum roll, please. This is the source for bar mitzvah. How do you know someone is a bar mitzvah when they're an adult, when they're 13 years old? It's from here, and we have in a calculation they were 13 years old, and they're referred to as an ish. They referred to as a man, right? So they're 13 years old. They couldn't, they wiped out the entire town. No matter how strong they were, no matter how weak the town was, they couldn't have been that many. Let's say a few dozen, right? Probably not a big town, right? Yes?
I'm warming the dog.
Great. It's a so really unfortunate name.
Yes.
Is that Willie's name, or is that like a description?
That's a very good question. As far as I know, the name Hamor means donkey, right? So I as far as I know, that was his name, right? I don't know. That could be that Hamor means donkey in Hebrew. Hamor could mean prince in a different Semitic language, right? There was the head of the UN, the was Kofi Annan, right? Kofi means
cafe.
Kofi. Right.
It's the way you pronounce it. My monkey.
My monkey. Right? Right. So I'm sure wherever he was from in Africa, it was a very lovely name. But all the Israelis made fun of him because the phrase is Kishmo came who? As is his name, so is he. Right? So that was his name, Kofi. So Hamor, that's the name. I don't know if his mother called him Little Hamari, right? Maybe he looked like a donkey. I don't know, right? But whatever, that's the name we're given. We're sticking with it. I'm saying it's an unfortunate name, right? So he went out to look. The Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Chivite, the prince of the region, saw her. He took her. He lay with her. So he abducted her. He kidnaps her. He sleeps with her. He rapes her. And he buys her. And he rapes her, right? What strange thing happens? The Tidbak Nafsho B'dinah Bat Yaakov. He became deeply attached to Dinah, the daughter of Yaakov. He loved her. He loved the maiden, appealed to the maiden's emotions. So Shechem spoke to Hamor, his father, saying, "Take me this girl for her wife." So this is a little strange. I'm not sure if it's strange. What we have here is he does this terrible thing. Clearly horrible, horrible thing. She's violated, she's raped. And then what's interesting is that he then falls in love with her, right? How does Dina feel about this? And he says, "I want to marry her." How does Dina feel about this relationship?
We have no idea.
We have no idea. We have no idea, right? The next question, would it matter? Remember, we're living in a time of society, according to Jewish law, incidentally, and this is in Parshat Ki Tetzeh, you'll find, and Jewish law will state, and we can look it up now, but you'll take my word for it, is that if a maiden is raped, violated by a Jewish man, what is the law?
He must marry her.
He must marry her, and he can never divorce her, right? Why? Because in that society, if someone was tainted because of this violation, they wouldn't be able to find a partner, right? There would be a shidduch crisis. And so instead, the law says, you know what? You're going to make sure that you're going to marry her, you're going to take care of her, because that's the responsibility of a husband to marry her, and you can never divorce her, so that's your responsibility. So it was not a crazy thing for Hamor, or for Shechem to say to her father, "I want to marry her." But he does say that he seems to be attracted to her and wants to marry her. It's interesting to note, and I chose this Tanakh, but I'm not sure, so we would look up other sources, but I'm not sure we're going to have time. There is a very similar scene or another scene of rape that takes place in the Tanakh where the response is very different. Anybody remember? Okay, we'll look it up. Take your magic ribbon, if you don't mind, okay? And go to chapter 12 of the book of, or chapter of the book of Kings, I'm sorry, book of Samuel 2, which I will announce the page in just a moment.
Okay, so
750.
Samuel
2.
755
is Samuel
2.
Okay, so.
Which chapter are we on?
We're in.
Chapter 12, you said?
Chapter 12,
we're in. I'm sorry, chapter 13, page 753. You have the story of the children of King David. I always tell people that we have this image and this of David, that he lives this beautiful life, he's a king, he plays the harp, he writes poetry. David had a very, very, very challenging life. There were a few good years, but he had a very, very challenging life. And in this scene in chapter 13, he has the story of Amnon and Tamar, and these are, Amnon is David's son, and Tamar is David's daughter, but they're half-siblings. So they share a father with a different mother. Tamar is incidentally the sister of Avshalom, also a half-brother. Amnon is the oldest son of David. Tamar is the is one of the daughters, right? And what happens is, it tells us right away that there is a lust. Verse 2, Amnon lusted to the point of illness for his sister. And for she was a virgin, but it seemed impossible for Amnon to do anything about her. So he sets up a whole system where he actually gets this advice, a crazy story. Somebody gives him advice, his cousin, and says, I have a great idea. Why don't you make believe you're sick, and then she'll cook for you. And after you have her alone, then you could have her. Then you could raise her. And so sure enough, that's what he did. And if you go to the text, it says in verse 8, Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house when he was lying down. She took some dough and kneaded it and prepared it in sight. And she cooked the dumplings. What are dumplings?
Penguins.
No. The Hebrew is levivot. What are levivot? What are levivot?
Pancakes.
No. Latkes. Latkes. Levivot are pancakes.
I was looking for
the
English
word. Pancakes, right. Pancakes. So they weren't kreplach. They were latkes, and here's actually the word I ask my kids this every year. My trivia: where are latkes in the Torah? Here, right here, it says levivot, right? And it's not. And so that's why my kids just love coming home to hang out with me. She then took the pan and poured it before him, but he refused to eat. Amnon then said, "Remove everyone from before me," and everyone went away from before him. Verse 10. Amnon then said to Tamar, "Bring the light meal into the room so that I may eat from your hand." By the way, this is kind of, for lack of a better term, this is like kinky, right? So we got PG-13 rated already. So Tamar took the dish and the dumplings that she had made and brought it into her brother Amnon into the room. She was serving them to him, and then he grabbed her and he said to her, "Come lie with me, my sister," which is just weird. And she said to him, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such things are not done in Israel. Do not commit this despicable act. Where could I go with my shame? And you would be considered in Israel as one of the despicable men. So now speak to the king, for he would not withhold me from you in marriage." And that's unclear if that's true, the king being her father, right, and his father. But it could be that she was just bargaining, right, and said, "Oh, you know, David's not going to let him marry her. It's an incest," right? But it could be that she was just bargaining. But he refused to heed her voice. He overpowered her and violated her and lay with her. And what happens in verse 15? Afterwards, Amnon despised her with a great hatred. His hatred was even greater than his love that he had felt to her. So Amnon said to her, "Get up and go away," and he throws her out.
Yes,
he throws her out, right? Now, this is interesting. Both are horrible stories, but you have the contrast between the two stories. Yeah. In the story of Shechem, he rapes her, and then he desires her. In the story of Amnon, he rapes her, and he is despises her. He hates her.
But he has a conscience.
It could be that because Amnon, that's a good point, Pat. Maybe because Amnon has a conscience, and out of the conscience, he said, "I just did something wrong." It's like lahavdil, like whatever. But if you do something, wrong, right? You're supposed to feel guilty, right? Even if you eat the whole bag of potato chips, right? You feel terrible afterwards. You wanted it at the time, but you feel terrible afterwards. You're not going to have another bag, right? But no, you'll feel emotionally terrible. Like, you feel guilty and terrible and horrible if you do something wrong, right? And it could be that Amnon had a conscience and Hamor doesn't. Although Hamor, or Ashchem in this case, Shechem is, it almost seems like he's acting with a certain amount of dignity, as we're about to see, while Amnon has, his act is completely despicable, right? And incidentally, Amnon, for those of you who want another spoiler, for those of you at the end of the story, is that Amnon, Tamar's brother, takes revenge and kills Amnon, and the rest is a domino effect of history. Which you'll have to read the story. Yes.
Also, the difference here: Tamar is saying, "Don't do this despicable act."
Well, we don't
Dina
hear.
Never.
We don't.
Said.
We don't hear what Dina says.
Right.
But clearly, she is from the text. It's an interesting point. Clearly, she's from the text. This is not something she wanted. Right. From the text, it says that she was violated. Right. This is not something that she's abducted and violated. So this is not something that she would have wanted, for sure. We don't know what kind of protests have taken place throughout this. Okay? It's interesting, this, the contrast of the two stories, and already, and I think Pat's point of perhaps there's there are scruples here that Amnon has, as despicable as he is, and that, although his response is completely inappropriate also, because then he throws around, right? But his conscience speaks to him, and he acts inappropriately, but his conscience speaks to him, while we have the story of Hamor and Shechem, where that doesn't seem to be an issue. In fact, so much so that when we're going to see the next line, we're going to see something explicitly missing, which we'll get to in just a moment. Susan?
I just think it's very interesting that she causes Dina by her not having a voice. Everything is caused a domino effect of what occurs to her, but she has nothing to contribute to it.
Welcome to the world 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
That was the world 4,000 years ago. Even the story, the law of a Jewish girl who gets raped by a Jewish boy, right?
Right.
A Jewish man, the girl has no voice. We don't say, do you want to marry him? I guess in theory, if she wanted to refuse, she could, right? But we don't, we just assume, well, we need to take care of you, and this, we're going to take care of you, this is how we're going to do it. It doesn't, she doesn't have a voice.
It's almost like she's a bystander, but she's the cause and effect.
Yes, because there's another part of this. There's another part of this, and that is that, of course, there's the terrible thing that happened to this woman, to Dina, but what is greater, I think, I'm going to speculate, or the more offensive, is the honor of the family. They're less concerned about Dina. Mm. They're more concerned about honor.
Well, this is where the Arabic tradition comes in, of the honor of the family, where they have honor killing.
Honor is a thing. Honor is a thing. Again, we're trying to put our, we can't put our 2019 values from 4,000 years ago, right? But it's here. This is the culture. The culture of honor, family honor, is a significant thing.
Still the honor in the Middle East.
Because their culture is 3,000 years old, right? Our culture is 2019. But there, we get a glimpse of what that was like by looking at the lives that they are in these various communities.
There's a reaction to her, to the act, and also when it says he loved the maiden and appealed to the maiden's emotions, how did she react to that? Did she say okay? Did she say no? Goodbye?
So it's a very good question. By the way, for all we know, and the text doesn't tell us, it could be that she understands, now that this has happened, right, which at the time probably wasn't terribly uncommon in this society, right? So now that this has happened, she's got to worry, what's going to happen to me now, right? What's going to happen to me now? Maybe, for all we know, she is okay with being married to this man because that's what you do. In other words, what are her options at this point? She's been terribly violated. Her life has been turned upside down. And now what are her options? She's not going to get married in society today anymore. So maybe she would be okay with it. We don't know. We don't know. The text is intentionally ambiguous. Dina is completely silent. We never hear from Dina again. The Midrash, by the way, tells us about Dina. Yeah, so you're going to learn something.
It's like a basket. They put her in like a something.
Well, the
she was brought from one place to another.
You're a step ahead because we're in the middle of the parsha. Rashi quotes a Midrash that tells us that a Tetzei Dina, that Dina went out, and actually this was a punishment for Yaakov because Yaakov put her in a box when she went to meet Esau because he was concerned that Esau would see her. She was a cute girl, and he would want to marry her, and he didn't want her to marry him. And this was a punishment. Now, why is that a punishment? Why is that? All of it, again, is a midrash. From the basic shot of the story that didn't happen, and then that she was just violated.
That's what Rashi said.
Rashi's quoting the Midrash. All right, everybody with me? We're ready to move on? Okay, so far the story's horrible. Doesn't get any better, right? Doesn't get any better. So we're in verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter, that he had defiled his daughter Dina, while his sons were with his cattle in the field. So Jacob kept silent until their arrival. Now the first question is, how did Jacob hear? Right? So if you were in Ira's Hebrew school, they tell you that he had prophecy, or they told them. What?
Maybe he knew
Dina is nowhere to be found. Dina is in the governor's mansion. No, she's not in a box. She's whether she's tied up or she's somewhere in the Shechem's house, right? But she's not. Well, there is no communication. She's not here, right?
So how did he hear?
Well, how would he hear?
People talk.
People talk, right? In other words, it didn't take long for the whole town to hear. Town, I'm going to guess, is not that big, and the yentas are going around, and so now people know. People know.
Juxtapose, the people are talking, but after all this happened, Jacob is silent.
People are talking, but Jacob is silent. Well, so Jacob is silent. Now, we can understand Jacob's silence in a different number of different ways. Where are there, Jacob's silence could be that he is, that's just his personality, that he is passive and doesn't know how to deal with things, and he kind of, in a number of cases, he's running away from his problems, and that, while at the same time, if we look at the end of Parshat Vayetze, he faces, stands up to Laban, and in the beginning of Parshat Vayishlach, he stands up to Esav, he's just generally, he's a person who gets nervous. He has certain anxiety issues and doesn't know how to deal with it, and so he's silent. It doesn't say how long he's silent, it doesn't say what his plan is. It just doesn't say. It does say that he's intentionally quiet, right? He has silence. By the way, we were talking about why this happened. There's an opinion that says that it happened because, we can't speculate, but someone speculated. Why did this happen to Jacob? Why did this terrible thing afflict him? Well, because where was he supposed to go after Esav? After his encounter with Esav, where was he supposed to go? Where was he returning from? He went from Laban's house. Where was he going back to? Where he came from? Where did he come from?
Canaan.
But where? At his father's house. He didn't go to his father's house. Why didn't he return to his father's house? He settled in Shechem. He doesn't return to his father's house. And so there was an opinion that said he was doing something wrong. Right? Again, I don't really know. That's not pshat. Right, but then you should be aware. We can speculate. He was hiding Dina. He didn't go home properly, etc., etc. Something is clearly, if you're looking for why divinely something happened, you can come up with a reason. But nonetheless, going back to the shot of the story, we have the scene. The scene is strange that the world, everybody's talking. The whole neighborhood is yakking away about this thing that happened. Right. So, in other words, it requires. Right. It's not like you can do a hush hush. That no one's, you know, let's keep this quiet, nobody knows, we'll keep it as a family secret. Can't do that, because everybody's talking. Everybody knows. And he keeps quiet. Now, practically speaking, if you put in a voice to Jacob and he's quiet, why is he quiet? Well, where are his kids?
They're in the field.
His sons were in the field. So, I would, if you were asking me, I mean, Jacob is the leader of the family, but probably if he needs to elicit a response, everybody has to come home first. And they're going to say, okay, we're going to have a family meeting. This is what happened. This is what we need to do. That it would be, so Jacob's silence could just be for the moment.
Very Machiavellian. We're going
to
plan all this out.
You have to have a response. There has to be something, right? Now, in the meantime, while he's waiting for his response, whether his response will ever come or not, we don't know. Another initiative comes forward, and that's on the top of page 85, verse 6. Hamor, Shechem's father, with the unfortunate name, went out to Jacob to speak to him. Jacob's sons arrived from the field when they heard what happened. Why did they? How did they hear what happened? Because they heard what happened, right? And because there was yenting going on, the sheep talk, right? Whatever. There's enough yenting going on. The men were distressed. They were fired deeply with indignation, as the phrase is heard, for he had committed an outrage in Israel by lying with the daughter of Jacob. Such a thing may not be done. Ki nabala asa b'Yisrael l'shkavet bat Yaakov v'chein lo ye'aseh. Who's speaking? The narrator. The narrator's speaking, which is basically describing what they're thinking. Their thinking was, what is offensive? What?
He lied with the daughter of Jacob.
He lied with the daughter of Jacob.
As opposed to he lied with our sister.
Right. Meaning, it's about family honor. Look what they've done. Now, keep in mind, right? There are two parts of family honor. One is honor, and the other is, and so honor requires vindication, right? But there's another part of this, right? Which is, if you are the 98-pound weakling, and you show up into the neighborhood, or on the beach, and some big, strong guy starts kicking sand in you, so what do you need to do, right? You can either walk away, right? Or
Give back.
Bulk up, right? And then he comes back the next summer and he's all got muscles and everything. And he says, you remember me? And he punches him in the head. He said, every morning I've been getting up at 5 a.m. working for this moment to punch you in the head. Why? Because not just about vindication. Because if he doesn't do it, what's going to happen? They'll do it again. And so ultimately, if we're going to live in this neighborhood, the brothers are saying, this thing can't be done. So if it's done, it's A, a violation to us and our family, but B, we're going to get punched around. We can't get punched around. We need to respond. We need to have a showroom, right? We need to have the JDL to go around.
The sermon that he gave Saturday.
And start smacking heads. Is that what I said?
Yeah.
That's not the sermon I gave Saturday.
He says we should fight back.
I don't know.
You didn't say it, but
I don't think I said that, but that's what you heard, which is a little scary for me.
Never again.
Okay. If I said it, good.
I think she was listening.
I'm not sure. Maybe I wasn't listening. Either way, it must have been great. This has been a great sermon, right? And so there you go.
So there were a lot of them, only two.
Because it's not just Shimon and Levi who's responding. It's all of them. All of the brothers feel as a daughter of, and it's interesting, by the way, Ki Navala Asa Bi Yisrael Lishkav Et Bat Yaakov. Because, and the language is fascinating, he had committed an outrage in Israel by lying with a daughter of Jacob. We have two things here. We have Jacob and we have Israel. Israel, this is a symbol. Israel is always, whenever it's used the word Yisrael, it refers to the nation. Right, national issues, the whole family versus Jacob, which is the head of the family. Right, so he has violated the family name. That's clear. It's an attack on their family. So, but in the meantime, we're in the middle. While this is happening, there's some sort of deal going on. Hamor, verse 8, spoke with them, saying, "Shechem, my son, longs deeply for your daughter." Now it's interesting who Hamor is speaking to. Vayedaber Hamor itam. Hamor is speaking with them. Who should he be speaking with?
He should be speaking to Yaakov, but
right.
He's speaking to his sons.
Why is he speaking to the sons?
Figure out it's easier.
Well, it could be that Jacob's just not responding.
That could be.
Right? That's a hint, perhaps, to tell us that when Jacob is silent, it just means he's fallen into some sort of melancholy depression and he's not responding. And they need to get somewhere. So they speak to them, being the sons. I mean, again, how old are Shimon and Levi at this point? Shimon and Levi are the second and the third oldest, and they're 13 years old.
But
right?
Then why does he say your daughter?
Right, well, because it's the family. Right. So it could be Yaakov is there. Could be speaking to the whole group. We don't really know.
Okay?
Hamor spoke to them, saying, Shechem, my son, longs deeply for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife. And intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourself. And among us you shall dwell. The land will be before you. Settle it and trade it and acquire property in it. Let's build the family. We're going to be a mishpacha, right? Show them out the mishpacha. What's now?
Didn't Jacob in the last chapter buy?
He bought a piece of land. Now he has real estate in the neighborhood. Right? He has real estate in the neighborhood. He lives in the neighborhood. Right? So he says, let's our family join your family, and you'll be one of us, we'll be one of you, and it'll all be great. Now, of course, you know, if you're concerned about intermarriage, this is an issue. But, practically speaking, right, in the world that we live in that time, 4,000 years ago, is an issue, a tribal issue, I should say. In order for your tribe, in order to survive, you need to be a tribe. Individuals don't survive, right? You need as many people as possible in your tribe in order to be able to live, right? In order to feed each other, in order to defend yourselves. This is a big thing. And so now Shem comes over and says, we'll make your tribe bigger. You will survive. It'll be easier for you to survive because we're going to band together. It's actually a very practical offer, It's a practical offer. What's missing in all this, by the way?
Because he looked at his brother who wasn't married.
Now Shechem, by the way, he doesn't know this.
Yeah.
He's just coming over and say, listen,
right,
you know what?
Now they're listening to this.
And clearly Shechem, or Hamor, he's going to be able to sell this to his people. He's clearly able to sell a lot of things to his people because he even gets them to circumcise themselves, right? Well, which is, wow, I mean, I as the leader of this community, there's no way I would be able to get everybody to do something like that, right? But Hamor is, he said, I can sell this to my people. Let's make a mirah. I don't know what your covenant is. I know you. You know, Abraham, we've heard of Abraham. Everybody heard of Abraham. Great, fantastic, but I don't know what your covenant is. Great, you know what? We'll band together. We'll be mishpacha. We'll see each other at weddings and bar mitzvahs, right? We'll have Thanksgiving together. Fine. What's the problem, right? So his offer is not crazy. I mean, it could be that it's not well received, but his offer is not a crazy idea because that's probably what happened, that tribes would band together. What's missing in his offer? Or at least in the dialogue that he brings?
He never mentions about his son marrying.
Yeah. Yeah, he said, Shechem, my son, longs deeply for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife.
Oh, okay.
No, you know what's missing? God is missing.
Okay, so that's very good, Susan, which makes things so ambiguous. Meaning, normally, if Moshe hits the rock, then God's angry. We know that he shouldn't have hit the rock, right? If things are happening, then we have God's response. In this conversation, God is missing, right? In this story, which is a very interesting story, and we have to ask, why is the story here? Many stories are not here. So what is it about the story that defines us, that's there to teach us? But God is clearly not present. God is clearly not present. When Abraham or Yitzchak go to the land of the Philistines and their wives are kidnapped, God responds and gets involved. Here, God is not involved. Right? We've had abductions before. We've had three. We've had two for Sarah and one for Rivka. And each time God intervenes, here God doesn't intervene. So it's a very good point. What else is missing in Shechem's or Hamor's dialogue with the family?
Nothing mentioned about the rape.
He didn't apologize.
Yeah.
Right? Nothing. Right. It doesn't acknowledge. Right. By the way, my son violated your daughter. I'm kind of sorry. I'm sorry about that. He's a nice boy. He's just misguided sometimes, and I don't know whether it's, you know, what he's involved with, the rock and roll and some bad friends, right? But if he came over to this family, I think it would have a good influence, and we can all make this into one big happy family. That somewhere that should have happened, right? So while Jacob, while the brothers are furious because of the honor of our people, right? Now, remember we mentioned there are two issues. One is honor, and the other is protection. Protection is that this could happen again. Hamor is coming over and saying, you never have to worry, this will never happen again, because I got boys. Our boys are going to make sure that your boys and your family is protected, because we're going to be one big family, so you never have to worry about this happening again. However, it doesn't resolve the first issue, which is the issue of honor. And these two... And the teenage boys who feel violated are livid, and they're unhappy. They can't be pacified. And so let's look at verse 13. Jacob's son answered Shechem, and his father Hamor cleverly. Interesting, the language that's used in Hebrew, that it says that the sons of Jacob answered Hamor b'mirma, with cunning. Right, the term with cunning. Anybody know where else we've seen that term, bimirma? Cunning, trickery. When Jacob stole the blessing, it was bimirma. It was the same language. And they said to him, and when they spoke him, because he had defiled their sister Dinah, and they said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to a man who is uncircumcised, for that is a disgrace for us. We have a covenant. But if you only on this condition will we acquiesce to you. If you become like us by letting every male among you become circumcised, then we will give you our daughters to you and take your daughters to ourselves. We will dwell with you and become a single people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, we will take our daughter and go." Now, this is an interesting negotiation, right? Because in the realm of negotiations, who has the upper hand?
The bigger guy.
Who has the bigger guy? Well, let's see. Who has the upper hand? Hamor or Jacob?
Jacob.
Why?
No, Hamor.
Because he was the one who was...
It was presented to him and he refused.
Jacob refuses.
Yeah.
Why? And there's a deal about being tried to be made. Who has the upper hand in the deal? In every negotiation, right, in the art of the deal, we're allowed to mention this, right? There are, everybody's trying to get the upper hand. Who has the upper hand?
Hamor.
Why?
Military wise.
The bigger. What
the
else?
Bigger.
They have land.
They're bigger because take a bet land too, right? But they're bigger. They have the home field advantage. What else? Taking sports. What else? They have the girl. They have the girl. Don't forget the girl. The girl is still being
still there.
She's still kidnapped. They have the girl. They're basically saying, you know, listen, we could release her under our conditions. But they have the girl. They have the numbers, they have the home field advantage, and they have the girl. And Hamor comes over in a very benevolent, probably wearing a suit, right? And he's wearing whatever, and he's trying looking very civilized, but at the end of the day, he's the mafia. And he's gonna say, we can do whatever we want, right? I don't have to release her, but I want to do this nicely, but I don't have to. Instead of Jacob, and so it makes sense, by the way, that Jacob, if you want just to give Jacob a break for a second, he's quiet. I don't know what to do. What do you do under these circumstances? And the incredible audacity of these teenagers who come along and say, listen, you know, you can have her, but only on this condition of the circumcision, right? But otherwise, we'll take her. What do you mean I'm going to take her? Right? That's a threat, by the way. That's a real threat. Because they can't take her. They can't get her. She's in the castle somewhere, or the mansion, or whatever it is. They can't just take her, but they're saying we'll get her back. We'll get her back. We'll rescue her, right? But we could do this your way. We'll do it your way, or if not, you don't have the upper hand. We can get her anytime we want. They're talking tough. Yeah.
Why is it that it's Jacob's sons, uh-huh, not Jacob?
Well, because Jacob. So either Jacob is still mulling over his options, right, or he's just not responding. And therefore, they take the leadership role. Incidentally, I mentioned that the whole Reuben scene that comes about the switching the beds, and we're not merely mentioning it, but we are mentioning it. Because what you find here clearly is a vacuum, is a hole in leadership. Who is the leader of the family? And what Jacob has displayed at this moment is that he is not the leader. And if he is not the leader, then someone else has to be. In this case, it's Shimon and Levi. In the next page, when Reuven switches the beds, which is the similar, he switches the bed. You could say the Midrash wants to say that he switched the bed. In the text, it says that he basically lies with Bilhah. He sleeps with Bilhah, right? Which is a similar act that Avshalom does much later. I'm not going to get into that right now in the interest of time, but it's a symbol of leadership. I am sleeping with my predecessors. Concubines is a symbol of leadership, right? So it could be that. You see that Yehuda is sort of takes the role of leadership, specifically with the selling of Yosef. It was his idea to sell him. And then you even see Joseph later on, who's much younger, but Joseph seems to try to take some sort of leadership role. All this happens during Jacob's lifetime because Jacob doesn't say, I am the leader, and I will be the leader until I'm no longer the leader, until I die. Right? And then I'll tell you who's going to be the leader. But because he doesn't do that, it could be it's not his personality or whatever, this leads an opportunity for somebody else, one of the children, to take leadership. Are we with me? How old is Jacob? He's about 100.
So he's an old man.
Excuse me. 100? Not that old, right?
Metushah was 900 years old. Right. 100 is not old.
No, Susan's right. Abraham became a father.
100 years old, right?
Right. Sarah was 90.
But he's clearly, he's lived a challenging, the last 30 plus years has been pretty challenging. And so he's definitely more passive. And we see that also even in next week's portion when we see in Vayeshev how Jacob's role in dealing with the brothers. He seems to be much more passive. He's older. He's gotten older, right? The last 30 years haven't been kind to him. All right. And it doesn't account to him again for the next 20 years after that. So let's go back to our story. Yes.
Your sermon was about the chosen people.
There you go. Thank you. I was listening too. Right.
Just to refresh.
Okay. It could have been a different week that I spoke. I chose that. That's correct. Thank you. Thank you, Pat. All right. So what they have this plan, bimirma, with trickery, that they get them all circumcised. And then what it is, verse 18, the proposal seemed good in the view of Hamor, and in the view of Shechem, Hamor's son. Right? We're going to do this. Now, again, so the youth did not delay in doing the things for he wanted Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most respected of all his father's household. Right? In other words, He said, we're all going to do this. The whole town is going to be circumcised. Why? Because I want to marry this girl. Right? Now, I don't know how we sold it.
That's just bizarre.
What?
That's just bizarre.
And the people seem to be okay with it. Now, you could speculate. Abraham's fame is well known. I mean, he's been gone for a while. He's been gone probably almost 100 years at this point. But his fame is well known. As this Nesesiyei Elokim, this Prince of God, as we saw in the beginning of Parshat Chayisara, the locals knew who he was. They probably knew who this family was. This wasn't just any tribe, right? And the descendants of Abraham. And so for them, it might have been a good thing to get in on Abraham's status. It could be. I don't know. Because otherwise, I don't know how he was able to sell that. He did a great job selling it.
Yeah.
Okay? So Hamor was this, with his son Shechem, came to the gate of the city and spoke to the people, saying, these people are peaceable with us. Let them settle in the land and trade in it, for see, there is an ample room in the land for them. Let us take their daughters for ourselves as wives and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the people acquiesce with us to dwell with us, to become a single people. And all our males become circumcised, as themselves are circumcised. Their livestock, their possessions, their animals, will they not be ours? Only let us acquiesce to them, and they will settle with us. Keep in mind that Jacob is extremely wealthy. Isaac was even more wealthy. And Isaac was the most wealthiest of them all. And of course, as we said, so whether they wanted spiritual pursuits or more likely financial pursuits, here they're seeing this very wealthy family that's coming. Jacob did very, very well in Laban's house. He has a huge flock. He said, listen, we get in on this family. And our tribe could basically acquire all the privileges or all of the assets and the estate of their tribe as part of one big mishpacha. So it sounds like it's a good deal for us. And that's how he's able to sell it. You had a comment? Okay. Verse 24. All the people depart through the gate of the city and listen to Hamor and to son Shechem. Crazy. And all the males, all those who depart through the gate of the city were circumcised. And it came to pass on the third day where they were in pain. When they were in pain, according to the tradition, the third day is the most painful. We did interview many Jewish boys who have had purses. They didn't have an answer. They didn't talk at that point. But if they could talk, they would say the third day is the worst. Right? So.
What about all the Russians that came?
Yeah, I don't know. I've actually been part of with conversions and who had of adults who had late circumcisions at a later age. I didn't ask them about the third day. The first day wasn't good either, by the way. So that's when the painkillers start wearing off, maybe after the third day.
You said that was also the day that Abraham was circumcised.
Also, it tells us that it was, right, that's the Midrash, that it was the third day after the circumcision, it was the most painful day. Right. Okay.
But there might have been more males in that town who desired women, and the women came from Jacob's tribe.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know anything about the women of Jacob's daughters, except for Dinah.
That's why they agreed to the circumcision.
They agreed. I think they agreed because they thought it was a good financial opportunity. That's my guess. Because business is business. You know, certain things men will do. They'll sacrifice a lot to make a few bucks. That's my thought. I don't know. Either way, Hamor was able to convince them for this, right? So he did. And it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain, the two of Jacob's sons, Simon, Shimon, and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword, and they came up to the city confidently and killed every male. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, they killed at the point of the sword. Then they took Dinah from Shechem's house and left.
Revenge.
Well, they had to get the girl, right? But they took this, they tricked them. And they took care of business. As I said, How large is the city? I don't know. You could probably, the city's probably not hundreds of people. It's probably a few dozen, right? But nonetheless, they basically decimate the city. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and they plundered the city which had defiled their sister. They made a few bucks on the deal as well. Their flocks, their cattle, their donkeys, whatever was in the town, whatever was in the field, they took. By the way, that's what happens. So the victors go to spoil. That's not unnatural.
Just the two of them, or all the sons?
Well, it says the sons of Jacob, but they were referred to as the sons of some. It's interesting. Their names keep jumping back and forth from the brothers of Dinah to the sons of Jacob, because they have two roles here, right? The Torah often does this and shows the tension between the two roles, right? When they keep calling them two different things, the sons of Jacob, the sons of Jacob, the brothers of Dinah. And all their wealth, all their children, and their wives, they took captives, and they plundered as well as everything in the house. And Jacob, in verse 30, and here's where we are. Jacob says to Shimon and to Levi, "You have discomposed me," which I don't even know what that means, right? "You've made me, making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Kenites and among the Perizzites. I am few in number, and should they band together and attack me, I will be annihilated, I and my whole household." You've put me in a terrible situation. They're going to see that we plundered the city, so now all the locals could attack us. And what's the response of Ayomru? And they said, and this is actually a phrase in Israel. It's a hachazonai aseh et achotenu ! Should he treat our sister like a harlot? Should our sister be treated like a prostitute? Right? What were we supposed to do? Scene ends. Curtain goes down, and we don't know. What's the story? What is Jacob's response to that? Dun, dun, dun. I don't know. And here's the question. Was Shimon and Levi correct? And that is the question. And in the 12 minutes that we have left, I'd like you to argue both sides.
Well, the only reason they were able to decimate the city is because the males were all circumcised, and they couldn't attack. They were
hurting.
In pain.
Right.
Okay, that was the idea.
So that's what they did, right? So was that right or was that wrong, in your opinion? You have to have an opinion.
It was right.
It was right. Why?
Because they wanted to protect the honor of their sister.
And the only way they were going to be able to do that, they were put in a compromised situation, forget about just the honor of their sister. They need to get their sister back. Right. How are they going to do that, right? So the only way they could do that is they trick them and then gain the advantage. Until this point, where is the advantage, we said? The advantage was with Shechem and Hamor, because they have the girl, and they have the power, they have the numbers. So they said, what did they do in the art of the deal? Is they just flipped the advantage. They said, okay, listen, and they took it, they put themselves in a position where they would be in the position of power, they would have the upper hand, and then they took it. So if Pat was saying there's nothing wrong with that, anybody disagree?
I disagree.
Tell us why, Susan.
Because they killed the innocent along with the guilty.
They killed the innocent along with the guilty. That's very nice. Who had kidnapped their sister? Hamor had done it. Shechem had done it. Who had violated their sister? The leadership. Now we're going to punish everybody for that, right? Now, there are those, including the Rambam, who makes your point, incidentally, and says, brilliantly, and says, you're right, they killed all of these people, but these people weren't innocent, because they knew, and they didn't respond. So they didn't necessarily do it, but they, because of their silence, everybody knew what happened, and they didn't go and start protesting and saying, in our town, we don't do such a thing. How can you do that? And we're going to vote you out or push you out or whatever it is. They didn't storm the governor's mansion. And so the Rambam says that they were guilty as well. Yeah. Just to say, you could disagree. That's what the Rambam says.
Okay.
So we got their sister back.
Yeah.
And they gave a real strong message to everybody else. People talk, right? People talk about this.
Well, that's what Jacob says. Jacob says, listen, you put me in a situation of danger.
Because they killed the innocent along with the...
Well, either, however they killed, they killed out a whole town.
They put him in a position of no one's going to mess with him. mess with the snappers. They saw where Kate.
Well, that was their response.
Right.
In other words, the last scene, and Ira brings this up, the last scene basically has a lot there because Jacob's like, what are you doing? He's like the nervous mother, right? No, he didn't wake up. He's saying, he's saying, you've put me at risk. Someone from the next town is going to open up the newspaper, right? And they're going to say, Jewish family shows up in town, decimates the entire town, right?
Don't
these are new people.
With
so you are going to say, don't mess it. Of course, they're a small tribe. They're 12 sons, young people, they're kids, right? Who's Shimon Levi said is 13 years old. Reuben is 14 years old, right? And so you've got a bunch of teenagers and little kids, and Jacob, they can't defend themselves against these major locals, right? And they're going to say, he's saying, you put me in a situation, our tribe could be wiped out in a second, right? And now, I'm nervous, I'm scared. And what do the boys say? They ain't going to mess with us, right? You might be scared, I think they're scared. They don't want to mess with us. We wiped out a whole town. Now, again, who's right? I don't know. Yeah.
My problem is that Jacob comes after the fact and admonishes them. Why were you not there in the beginning? Why did you not take the leadership role and say to your sons, don't do this?
Well,
excuse me. His sons were out in the field working. They did what they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. The daughter decided to take the walk.
Well, okay.
We can't blame the victim.
We're not here to blame the victim because then we
don't
get
blame
there.
The victim, right.
Here he has a voice, Jacob.
He can admonish his children. He disagreed with them. By the way, when he disagrees with them or what they did, on what basis does he disagree with them?
He fears as to what's going to happen.
Right. What basis does he not disagree with them?
What they did to the sister.
What they did to the somebody else.
They didn't ask him.
No. Well, okay. What basis does he not disagree with them? What basis does he not yell at them for? He chastises them. He doesn't feel there was an ethical problem here.
Right.
He doesn't say, this is not how we behave. This is not, you killed out the whole city for the sins of one person. He doesn't say that.
But there's a problem with that, too.
Right. Well, but he doesn't say it, meaning clearly it doesn't bother him.
Doesn't
right? If he bothered him, he would have said it. What he said was, is that we're now all at risk, which, by the way, as we said before, if you're a tribe, tribes get wiped out in a second during this period of time, right? And so he said, we don't have any friends. We don't have any friends, right? So if you have... we're now at risk, at a greater risk. Turns out that he was wrong because we don't see any other attack, right? So, but at the time,
you don't know.
That's Monday morning quarterback, right? There's a great commentary, and I got to say this because it's like crazy. So there's a commentary called the Kli Yakar, who's, I don't remember his real name. I don't remember anything. I should have looked it up beforehand. And he asks,
what? Kli
is a vessel. Yakar is precious. But that's his name. It's a commentary. I think he was Italian in the 15th century, but I'm throwing this out. Right? Precious vessel. That's what's for Kli Yakar. But that's his commentary. And he asks the simple question, which is, why didn't they respond? Right? Shouldn't they have felt a risk and they should band together and just an attack? Right? So there might be an answer, by the way, is that if you remember, Abraham fought a war with his men, right, and was victorious, and which was quite miraculous in Parshat Lech Lecha, Parshat Vayera, Lech Lecha, Parshat Lech Lecha, where he fights a war, and he saves, and he beats these kings, a whole bunch of kings. So he's clearly Abraham is a warrior. But so that could be it, but I doubt it. I'll tell you what the Kli Yakar says. The Kli Yakar says, is that when you can't wait to say this, he said what happened was is that when these people of Shechem, they in the town, they circumcised, right? And so when they circumcised, everybody outside just assumed that they became Jewish, and said when Jews get killed, nobody cares. That's what he said.
Really taking a leap.
But it depends on what time period you live in. If you live in a time when Jews are being persecuted for no reason other than being Jewish, that's going to be on the tip of his mind.
Not only then it's getting the upper hand, because you don't want these people attacking you. You want to show that you're... So
that is Shimon Levi's response.
They were deceptive in the way they acted. And wasn't Jacob deceptive when he wanted the power?
When right, so deception. So they could say, "Dad,
it's all the same.
Listen, at the end of the day, you're saying right. At the end of the day, they could say, "Dad, listen, we needed. A man's got to do what a man's got to do, right? You did it, and we did it, right? Exactly. I'll tell you what the Ramban says. Nachmanides says this is a response. He says, you know, that the reason why they were wrong was because, and what Jacob was upset about is that they made a deal with Shechem, and they didn't honor the deal. So they came to them with as if there was a deal, right? And they shook hands on it, and they didn't honor the deal, and that is a disgrace to the family as well. That's the Ramban says, and that's why Jacob was right and they were wrong. And incidentally, to note, at least in Jacob's opinion, if you turn the page, a few pages, to Parshat Vayechi, you have the blessings of the children. On page 125, page 127, and you have on chapter 49, verse 5, on page 127, where now 40 or so years later, Jacob is on his deathbed and he blesses or gives his last will and testament to his children. And it says, and he goes to Shimon and Levi, and he says, verse 5, Shimon and Levi are comrades. Their weaponry is a stolen craft. Into their conspiracy may my soul not enter. With their congregation do not join. Oh, my honor! For in their rage they murdered people, and at their whim they hamstrung an ox. Accursed is their rage, for it is intense, and their wrath, for it is harsh. I will separate them from within Jacob, and I will disperse them in Israel. In his last will and testament, Jacob gets the last word, right? And he says, boy, did you take me off. Right? This was a terrible thing that you did. And he curses them. Or I should say, curse is your rage. Right? Right. Well, what the commentary has been pointing out is he doesn't curse them. He curses their anger. He curses their that they were impetuous and angry. And so therefore, the he says, the Shimon and Levi should not live next to each other because they'll conspire with each other, and they were separated from where they were from the division of land. Maybe they didn't even have land, but they would be separated. So clearly Jacob is not happy about this. Although, what is Jacob's response at the time after they do this? Also nothing. Right now, I'm going to play one more thing to make it more complicated, which is that if you remember, what is much of the final book, of the final chapters, the final portions of the book of Bereshit is of conflict between whom? The conflict between whom? If you go through Parshat Vayeshev, Parshat Vayikets, Vayigash, Vayechi, who's the main character? At the end of the last?
Joseph.
Right? And where does Joseph end up? He ends up in Egypt. Why does he end up in Egypt? Because he had a conflict with
his brothers.
This conflict doesn't just stem from here, but stems from beforehand. Why? Because there was a conflict between the mothers of the other brothers and the mother of Joseph. There was a problem or a conflict between Rachel and Leah, the two sisters, right? Now, it would make sense, incidentally, and it doesn't get talked about enough. It says that Leah was snua. Leah was hated, right? And they want to say she wasn't as hated. It says Rachel was loved, that Rachel was loved, and Leah was hated. And it really shouldn't be that she wasn't hated, whatever. Listen, at the end of the day, Yaakov marries Leah. He didn't want to marry Leah. Leah's father tricked him. And in order for this to happen, Leah had to be complicit in this. And so it would make sense that Jacob, who's now stuck with this woman, this woman to be his wife, is not going to be happy with her. That's Midrash. That's the Midrash. It's not in the text.
Yeah. The resentfulness toward Leah translates to her sons.
And
consequently those sons...
So if the sons are feeling like second-class citizens from the beginning, and incidentally, Jacob decides who's the firstborn in Jacob's eyes. It's Joseph. He gives him a double portion. He gives him the technical dream code, which is a sign of leadership. In his eyes, that's not really his children. The main children are Joseph and Benjamin, Rachel's children, right? And now, who is violated? Who's the daughter of who? The daughter of Jacob and daughter of Leah. So the brothers are coming along and saying, "Hey, Dad, what's the matter? If it was Rachel's daughter, wouldn't you have done something? Who are we? Are we not important?" And it's a symbol or a sign of much of the tension that has happened before and is continuing afterwards. This is a family that needs therapy for sure, right?
But did you say that the seeds were already started with Rivka when she already told Jacob to be deceitful?
I think what you're saying, because that word bimirma, that of trickery and is present here. So it's still playing that. It's still playing that. Clearly the text is there as a message of tying in from the sideboard.
Go back to the sins of the father, opposed to the sins
of
the children.
So I don't know. I don't think we concluded anything. But we tackled a story that is, again, very ambiguous and has many different ways to looking at it. But by the way, it's not just us. The commentaries, the Rambam, the Ramban, and many others will have very different schools of thought on who was right and who was wrong, and I hope we got a chance to appreciate some.